Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live, I first had the chance to interview when I was on Fresh Air somewhere, was it 89 or 90? And it was a book called Failure to Zigzag. She's since written other books, and the new one is called A Pocket History of Sex in the 20th Century. Mm. And it really covers from the mid-17th century up until Christo's The Gates in New York City in many ways. But in many ways, it focuses on the author's upbringing in Southern California, the daughter of some Bohemian parents. Her father commits suicide when she's a young woman, perhaps because he was gay and constantly being arrested by the LA Vice Squad, or perhaps because of other reasons. Perhaps it was the pressure of the incessant psychoanalysis that people were going through at the time. But who knows? Nevertheless, it's a remarkable book written by Jane Vandenberg. Please welcome her to West Coast.
Hi.
It requires a pretty big pocket to put this book in if it's a pocket history of sex.
I meant for it to be small. I've been intending to write a short book. Yeah. I keep intending to write a short book.
But this is not a short book.
No.
I mean, but it is filled with writing that's moving and funny and wise. It's 374 pages.
374 pages, yeah.
And it's published by Counterpoint Press, mm-hmm. which is run by your husband.
That's right.
And he's a character in the book.
Yes, he is. For a while, I was calling him Jay in that old-fashioned. I didn't have a dash or a hyphen after, just Jay. But the alphabet I was using looked, the J looked exactly like the I. So it sounded like...
On the typeface?
Yeah, it said I and I all the time. And then I thought, well, you know, people are going to figure it out that it's Jack. I'm talking about Jack.
Jack Shoemaker, who ran North Point Press, mm-hmm. in which first published Anne Lamott, and publisher of Evan Cannell. And then later he went to Counterpoint Press, which was based in Washington. You tell this story in the book. And now Counterpoint is back here. And in the small world of things, we've had a number of writers on the show, including my wife, have been published by Counterpoint. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, small world.
Small world.
Small.
But when you start out this story, it's also a small world of growing up in Southern California. Your parents are kind of exiles from the wealthy part of the family who live in Pasadena and San Marino, and you're allowed to run free as you want, to be truant from school, to play on the beaches, to become a surfer, whatever mm-hmm. you want.
Yeah, the world was not presented to me and to my brothers as a dangerous place. There was no such thing as stranger danger. We didn't know from kidnapping. My mother, I mean, why ever would anybody kidnap us, was her attitude, not them. It would never have occurred to them.
And meanwhile, she's inside the house smoking cigarettes, drinking Pabst beer, and drawing storyboards for Disney.
Right. Right, she was.
That's the Southern California combination.
Yes, yeah, and he was an architect. He worked on Miracle Mile. He actually, at the time of his death, was working on Century City. My big brother says that he died of the ugliness of buildings, the buildings that shut people out and had mirrors on the outside, and what was being done to Los Angeles. Yeah.
And one of the main characters of the book, who is really sort of a hero, is your aunt.
She is a hero, yes. She's alive. I didn't actually start to work on this book in terms of publishing it until my aunt called me one day and said, oh, my dear, I really must tell you that I've joined hospice. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't lose my aunt. She's the last of this generation. And got on a train and went to visit her in Salt Lake City. And the other part of my mind was thinking, I can publish my book now. Because these stories have upset her. It was her brother and her decimated family and this horrible, these things. I, you know, in the way of children, I thought that all of this stuff had only happened to me, my father's suicide, my mother's insanity. But that isn't exactly the way a family works. And my aunt had suffered mightily. She really was a completely heroic and very stoic and seemed to me very Western woman in this way. My family is a long time in the West, and this stoicism was remarkable. Uncomplaining, she was a woman who had, at the time that she inherited, these three absolute hellions, my two brothers and I, who had, were not disciplined in any way. She already had four children of her own and an errant husband and a dangerously alcoholic mother who used to put all her seven grandchildren into her Studebaker and drive around in the fog. Very scary. And my aunt suffered all that. She was the fulcrum of this family. She had no sister. None of the women in my family had sisters. It was absolutely remarkable that it was so dominated by boys. We had flurries of these tall, good-looking boys, no girls. And so my aunt was doing that all on her own.
She grounds you at one point, and and you get a phone call from some guy you don't really know. You're 16, 15?
Mm-hmm.
And you think you know this person, and he invites you out into this to meet you somewhere, and you come up with this elaborate ruse of making this dummy girl in your bed, mm-hmm. complete with fake hair and rollers mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sneak out, and then you make use of these high cinder walls with red tile on them to use that the kids all use as pathways to then escape through somebody else's house to meet this kid, which mm-hmm. turns out not to be a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to call this aunt, who you've dreaded, actually, mm-hmm. to come rescue you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my aunt, because of the family history of her mom driving us around drunk, had made a promise to my cousins and to me, who were all at the verge of driving, that if any of us was drunk or in a car with somebody who was drinking, no questions asked, we could call her. That was our one get out of jail free. My aunt was extremely strict. I'd been grounded because she found out that some months before I'd gone to a drive-in movie with a boy, and I was not allowed to go to a drive-in. You know what happened there. Kissing. That was, you know.
Kissing in a public space.
Yeah, in a car. So I had to get away from this boy who turned out to be not only drunk, but, you know, marginally sociopathic, I think.
You recognized the odor of alcohol and juicy fruit gum on yeah. his breath. It was just, that would have made me want to retch in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Scarier and scarier situation. So he drove up into the hills of Chatsworth, which was just then being built. We were looking supposedly for this party. I didn't want to be with him, but I wanted to go find my friends, and especially the boy, whatever boy that I liked, which was not this one. And he wouldn't let me out of his car, and it felt really like it was becoming a dangerous situation. I told him I was going to throw up in his car, which he had stolen from his brother, and so I think that convinced him that he ought to let me go throw up in the Texaco station. So I went into the Texaco. My aunt came to get me, and it was remarkable. It was a family that was not demonstrative emotionally. But at the time that she realized, I didn't know exactly what had happened, but I had used I could call her, and I would not be, what my family did was when the infractions were, you just crossed the line, you were sent away to boarding school. It had happened to my older brother. He was in military academy, actually, here at San Rafael. And so I imagined that I would be sent away to boarding school for this infraction. But no, my aunt held my hand for my family. That was a huge, big deal. Huge, big deal.
You noticed tears in her eyes.
Yeah.
But you never talked about what was going on.
No, we were taught not to cry. We did not cry. It was a very Western situation. We'd had to have walked 200 or 2,000 miles from independence and you just learned not to cry. I did. I learned not to cry because my dad killed himself. One did not cry in the face of that kind of thing. And after that, it really, I think that it was Mary McCarthy who said that childhoods like mine, like hers, she lost both her parents in influenza. She said it tends to dry one's tears. So we were not a family that cried. We were not a family that particularly kissed one another. We did not hold hands. So the fact that my aunt had reached over and held my hand was just remarkable to me. And I have to say that my aunt gave me this call a couple of years ago. I think it was actually 2 years ago in April. And I said to her, "What does that mean, hospice?" She said, "Well, they give you like a 6-month window, something like that." And I thought, okay, takes a year to get the book to the publisher, and then a year after that. My aunt, I must say, is very much with us.
And has she read the book?
She has read the book. She is delighted with this book. So things can change. They honestly can change. It's dedicated to her. She wrote me just last week, and she said she comes to the dedication again and again, and she says, "Sometimes I forget that it's dedicated to me, and then I'm delighted all over again." She's 87. She's absolutely remarkable.
You have a line about her that says, my aunt believed in hot breakfasts the way she believed in the Nicene Creed.
Yeah. She was a staunch Episcopalian. Sometimes I thought that everyone in my family was either completely and utterly alcoholic and psychoanalytic, that was their religion, or Episcopalian, and that was my aunt, except in the case of my paternal grandmother, who was both.
Now that is a deadly combination.
Yeah, she was the one with the Studebaker and the grandchildren cowering in the back. Very scary woman.
There are many aspects of this book which show up in time again, but there is, for instance, our mother had, our mother has other versions that are elaborated over time. They go way back and back to what's always been wrong with everything. And this has to do with Calvinism and what it says about the human body, which is that we are born in iniquity, which is another word for vice, capital V, which is another word for the LAPD, which has special problems of its own. I mean, there's a lot in one sentence there.
Yes. My mother had a theory that there had to be something very, very wrong with LAPD vice for them to be in the men's bathrooms at jazz clubs to arrest my father. She didn't believe that it was her problem or his problem. It was their problem. And I think we maybe have come far enough that we can agree.
There's a scene in which you talk about the women who've come west, giving up everything that they had in the east, the clouds that they recognized, the sounds of the birds that they recognized, and why they wore black dresses, because they were in mourning for leaving a life that they would never go back to. Mm-hmm. Childbirth was dangerous. You know, they would give birth, they would bleed to death on the trail. I mean, it's a very moving depiction of what women went through to come west to be with the men who wanted them there.
Yeah, I think often that there was absolutely no choice for them. It was one's lot was. Women also, until the 20th century, this was absolutely true in my family. It was an Oregon Trail family. Every woman statistically lost a child. So that then women died so often in childbirth or in, I think honestly, because they were worked to death. The story of not only having one's own children, but then inheriting one's sister's children when she died, or in my aunt's case, her brother's kids. It seemed somehow typically Western, and the stoicism with which she comported herself and the dignity that with which women simply worked in the West. My grandmother on my mother's side was very much of that that look and demeanor that one simply walked to 2,000 miles from independence. One then just worked and worked And it was really something.
And in a way, that sort of world without those kinds of pressures and stresses sort of allowed, in many ways, your parents to kind of flail and not know what a purpose. They couldn't find a purpose in life.
Yeah, my parents, my mother said that, they would have done very well in a garret in Paris. That would have been just fine for them. But I think that my parents went away from Southern California to Cal. It's where my grandparents met. It's where my parents met. And the bohemian experience, and also the fact that my mother would always say, she said when we were to mark the boxes that say F or M for sex, we didn't call it gender, of course, we didn't have that word, it was sex. We weren't to mark those boxes, we were to mark other. She said, I am other, your father is other, and you are other too. We'd say, well, they don't really ask us that question, Mom. And she said, well, they will. So I think that a lot of it had to do with the fact that neither of them really fit particularly well in the 1950s when gender roles were becoming extremely strict in reaction to, I think it was the swing back to, it was McCarthy, it was also getting women back out of the workforce and back into suburbia, which is where they were all losing their minds. And so in some way, they were typical. They were also, he was the firstborn boy. He was, I think this is fair enough to say, somewhat spoiled. He sort of got his way. My mother was an only child, and she also was somewhat spoiled. They were enormously talented. It was called the radiant child syndrome. My parents were both very, very bright and had advanced and were, my mother was just a brilliant painter at a very young age. She went to Chouinard Art School at 16. She'd graduated from high school. They wouldn't take her at Cal because she was too young. And so they simply, in one version, I just don't think they lasted long enough to get to the 1960s where they belonged. You know, it had, you know.
They were a decade too early.
A little bit, yeah, just a little bit too early. Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get to the 60s, you're reveling in the freedom of being an independent woman.
Mm-hmm. I'm reveling. I was also terrified because it was not only freedom but license. And I was afraid, you know, of what I carried. I had it, nature, nurture. I had it. I was California, you know. I mean, it was coming at me every which way, trying to find the path that fit.
The book is in two halves. The second half is sort of speed ahead. Mother of two kids. You become married with Jack, who's got two kids. You're living in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Deciding whether or not to move to Washington, D.C. I mean, why did you choose to make the break in the story there?
Well, I wrote, have been writing the beginning of this book for a very long time. Part of it was my master's thesis at State when I was in graduate school. I've been at it a long time. The material is extremely painful. A lot of it was so hard that I could write a story and then I couldn't write it.
But it's also so funny.
I think it is funny. I think it is funny. I think that we have to laugh at it, but it was hard to write. And the trajectory of the story launches this, I think of her sort of as that girl, who the one that I was, in a certain direction. And then the middle part of the book, which reviewers have said I seem to have forgotten to write, I haven't forgotten to write it. I have, for instance, not forgotten the fact that one of my brothers did not make it and is...
That was George.
Right, my youngest brother is homeless. And I didn't forget this. It's simply that I could not load this narrative down with any more of that. I absolutely intend to do that work also. And I'm not afraid of the work. It just felt to me that we had to get to a place where I could find some redemption. You know, I feel that both my older brother and I, through a miracle grace, you know, through hard work, through a lot of things, have enormously fulfilled and interesting lives, and that was not at all predictive in terms of that. I mean, in Freudian psychoanalysis, we really did not look like great candidates for anything. We were extremely troubled young people, and we're still quite eccentric and often a pain in the, and I can't say the word ass on, yeah? Is that one of them?
I can't remember. Yeah, no, I don't think that's fun.
There's seven.
No, that's you can say pain in the ass. That's
okay,
right.
Okay, good.
I think.
But that through that miracle that we were here, and I wanted, for whatever reason, I felt like I, you know, I'm a little bit ashamed of the fact that I was the kid who would always show up at a party. My two brothers, my mother and I, were the ones, the Vandenbergs, who had this great, glorious name, show up, and what we wanted to do was make jokes about killing yourself, because we would say it over and over, suicide, 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 you know, because it was not only a way of buffering ourselves from this horrible event that had happened to us, it was actually something that we needed to say that was an accusation against the society that I felt in many ways had killed my dad. I felt it was wrong. The things that had happened to my parents were wrong. And so that I felt with the book, I need to write the middle part of the book, but it's called The Etiquette of Suicide, which is a little bit about not being the person to show up in any party where people are having a really good time and saying, how are you? Good. My father killed himself. I mean, that's what we did just absolutely naturally. And my mother was insane. You know, that sort of thing in order to introduce ourselves in our most, the core of who we were.
It's a remarkable journey. I look forward to that middle part, but you know, whenever you choose to do it, and whenever it comes out. The book is called A Pocket History of Sex in the 20th Century by Jane Vandenberg, published by Counterpoint. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sedge.
Thank you. Thank you. This is Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.